Chapter 2. By 1908, the Van Dorn Detective Agency maintained a presence in all American cities of consequence, and its offices reflected the nature of each locality. Headquarters in Chicago had a suite in the palatial Palmer House. Dusty Ogden, Utah, a railroad junction, was served by a rented room decorated with wanted posters. New York's offices were in the sumptuous Knickerbocker Hotel on 42nd Street. And in Washington, D.C., with its valuable proximity to the Department of Justice, a prime source of business, Van Dorn detectives operated from the second floor of the capital city's finest hotel, the New Willard on Pennsylvania Avenue, two blocks from the White House. Joseph Van Dorn himself kept an office there, a walnut-paneled den bristling with up-to-date devices for riding herd on the transcontinental outfit he commanded. In addition to the agency's private telegraph, he had three candlestick telephones capable of long-distance connection as far west as Chicago, a DeVoe dictaphone, a self-winding stock ticker, and an electric Kellogg intercommunicating telephone. A spy hole let him size up clients and informants in the reception room. Corner windows overlooked the Willard's front and side entrances. From those windows, a week after Arthur Langner's tragic death at the naval gun factory, Van Dorn watched apprehensively as two women stepped down from a streetcar, hurried across the bustling sidewalk, and disappeared inside the hotel. The intercommunicating phone rang. "Miss Langner is here," reported the Willard's house detective, a Van Dorn employee. "So I see." He was not looking forward to this visit. The founder of the Van Dorn Detective Agency was a heavily built, bald-headed man in his 40s. He had a strong Roman nose, framed by bristling red whiskers, and the affable manner of a lawyer or a businessman who had earned his fortune early and enjoyed it. Hooded eyes masked a ferocious intelligence. The nation's penitentiaries held many criminals gulled into letting the big gent close enough to clamp on the handcuffs. Downstairs, the two women riveted male attention as they glided through the Willard's gilt and marble lobby. The younger, a petite girl of 18 or 19, was a stylishly dressed redhead with a vivacious gleam in her eyes. Her companion was a tall, raven-haired beauty, somber in the dark cloth of mourning, her hat adorned with the feathers of black terns, her face partially veiled. The redhead was clutching her elbow as if to give her courage. Once across the lobby, however, Dorothy Langner took charge, urging her companion to sit on a plush couch at the foot of the stairs.
"Are you sure you don't want me to come with you?"
"No, thank you, Catherine. I'll be fine from here."
Dorothy Langner gathered her long skirts and swept up the stairs. Catherine D. craned her neck to watch Dorothy pause on the landing, turn back her veil, and press her forehead against a cool, polished marble pillar. Then she straightened up, composed herself, and strode down the hall, out of Catherine's sight and into the Van Dorn Detective Agency. Joseph Van Dorn shot a look through the spy hole. The receptionist was a steady man. He would not command a Van Dorn front desk were he not, but he appeared thunderstruck by the beauty presenting her card, and Van Dorn noted grimly that the wild bunch could have stampeded in and left with the furniture without the fellow noticing.
"I am Dorothy Langner," she said in a strong, musical voice. "I have an appointment with Mr. Joseph Van Dorn."
Van Dorn hurried into the reception room and greeted her solicitously.
"Miss Langner," he said,
the faintest lilt of Irish in his voice softening the harder tones of Chicago.
"May I offer my deepest sympathy?"
"Thank you, Mr. Van Dorn. I appreciate your seeing me."
Van Dorn guided her into his inner sanctum. Dorothy Langner refused his offer of tea or water and got straight to the point.
"The Navy has let out a story that my father killed himself. I want to hire your detective agency to clear his name."
Van Dorn had prepared as much as possible for this difficult interview. There was ample reason to doubt her father's sanity. But his wife-to-be had known Dorothy at Smith College, so he was obliged to hear the poor woman out.
"I am, of course, at your service, but
The Navy says that he caused the explosion that killed him, but they won't tell me how they know.
I wouldn't read too much into that, said Van Dorn. The Navy is habitually secretive. What does surprise me is they tend usually to look after their own.
My father deliberately established the gun factory to be more civilian than naval, Dorothy Langner replied. It is a business-like operation.
And yet, Van Dorn ventured cautiously, as I understand it, civilian factories have recently taken over many of its duties.
Certainly not. Fours and sixes, perhaps, but not the dreadnought guns.
I wonder whether that shift troubled your father.
Father was accustomed to such shifts, she answered dryly, adding with a faint smile. He would say, the slings and arrows of my misfortunes are the tugs and pulls of Congress and local interests. He had a sense of humor, Mr. Van Dorn. He knew how to laugh. Such men don't kill themselves.
Of course, Van Dorn said gravely. The Kellogg rang again. Saved by my bell, Van Dorn thought to himself. He stepped to the wall where the instrument was mounted, picked up the earpiece, and listened. Send him in. To Dorothy Langner, he said, I asked Isaac Bell, my best operative, to step down from an important bank robbery case in order to look into the circumstances of your father's death. He is ready to report. The door opened. A man in a white suit entered with an economy of motion unexpected in one so tall. He was well over 6 feet, leanly built, not more than 175 pounds, and looked to be about 30 years old. The full mustache that covered his upper lip was gold, as was his thick, neatly trimmed hair. His face had the robust appearance of an outdoorsman who was no stranger to sun and wind. His large hands hung still at his sides. His fingers were long and precisely manicured, although an observer keener than the grieving Dorothy Langner might have noticed that the knuckles of his right hand were red and swollen. Miss Langner, may I present Chief Investigator Isaac Bell? Isaac Bell assessed the beautiful young woman with a swift, penetrating glance. Mid-twenties, he estimated her age, intelligent and self-possessed, desolated by grief yet extraordinarily attractive. She turned to him beseechingly. Bell's sharp blue eyes softened in an instant. Now they were tinged violet, his inquiring gaze veiled with tenderness. He took off his broad-brimmed hat in deference to her, saying, I am so sorry for your loss, Miss Langner, and swept a drop of blood from his hand with a pure white handkerchief in a motion so graceful as to be invisible. Mr. Bell, she asked, what have you learned that will clear my father's name? Bell answered in a voice pitched low with sympathy. He was kindly yet direct. Forgive me, but I must report that your father did indeed sign out a quantity of iodine from the laboratory store. He was an engineer, she protested. He was a scientist. He signed for chemicals from the laboratory every day. Powdered iodine was an essential ingredient of the explosive that detonated the smokeless powder in his piano. The other was ammonia water. The porter noticed a bottle missing from his cleaning closet. Anyone could have taken it. Yes, of course. But there are indications that he mixed the chemicals in his private washroom. Stains on a towel, a volatile powder on his toothbrush, residue in his shaving mug. How can you know all this? She asked, blinking away angry tears. The Navy won't let me near his office. They turned away my lawyer. They even barred the police from the gun factory. I gained admittance, said Bell. A male secretary wearing a vest, bow tie, banded shirt sleeves, and a double-action Colt in a shoulder holster entered urgently. Beg your pardon, Mr. Van Dorn. The commandant of the Washington Navy Yard is calling on the telephone, and he's hopping mad.
Tell the operator to switch the line to this telephone. Excuse me, Miss Langner.
Van Dorn here.
Good afternoon, Commandant Dillon. How are you today? You don't say.
Van Dorn listened, casting Miss Langner a reassuring smile. Well, if you'll forgive me, sir, such a general description could fit half the tall men in Washington. It could even describe a gentleman right here in my office as we speak. But I assure you that he does not look like he's been at fisticuffs with the United States Marines. Unless the Corps turns out a lesser breed of leatherneck than in my day.
Isaac Bell put his hand in his pocket. When Joseph Van Dorn next replied to the caller, it was with a benign chuckle, though if the Commandant had seen the chill in his eyes, he might have retreated hastily.
No, sir. I will not produce an employee of mine on your sentry's assertion that they caught a private detective red-handed. Clearly the man in my office was not caught, as he is standing here in front of me. I will register your complaint with the Navy Secretary when we lunch tomorrow at the Cosmos Club. Please convey my warmest regards to Mrs. Dillon.
Van Dorn replaced the earpiece on its hook and said, Apparently, a tall, yellow-haired gent with a mustache knocked down some Navy Yard sentries who attempted to detain him.
Bell displayed a row of even white teeth.
I imagine he'd have surrendered quietly if they hadn't tried to beat him up.
He turned back to Dorothy Langner, his expression gentler. Now, Miss Langner, there is something I must show you. He produced a photographic print, still damp from the developing process. It was an enlarged photograph of Langner's suicide note. He had snapped it with a 3A folding pocket Kodak camera that his fiancée, a woman in the moving picture line, had given him. Bell shielded most of the photograph with his hand to spare Miss Langner the deranged raving. Is this your father's handwriting? She hesitated, peered closely, then reluctantly nodded.
It looks like his handwriting.
Bell watched her closely.
You seem unsure.
It just looks a little... I don't know. Yes, it is his handwriting.
I understand that your father was working under great strain to speed up production. Colleagues who greatly admired him admit he was being driven hard, perhaps beyond endurance.
Nonsense, she snapped back. My father wasn't casting church bells. He ran a gun factory. He demanded speed. And if it were too much for him, he would have told me. We've been thick as thieves since my mother died.
But the tragedy of suicide, Van Dorn interrupted, is that the victim can see no other escape from the unbearable. It is the loneliest death.
He would not have killed himself in that manner.
Why not? Asked Isaac Bell.
Dorothy Langner paused before she answered, noting, despite her grief, that the tall detective was unusually handsome, with an air of elegance tempered by rugged strength. That combination was a quality she looked for in men, but found rarely.
I bought him that piano so he could take up music again, to relax him. He loved me too much to use my gift as the instrument of his death.
Isaac Bell watched her compelling silvery blue eyes as she pleaded her case.
Father was too happy in his work to kill himself. 20 years ago, he started out replicating British 4-inch guns. Today, his gun factory builds the finest 12s in the world. Imagine learning to build naval guns accurate at 20,000 yards. 10 miles, Mr. Bell.
Bell cocked his ear for a change of tone that might express doubt. He watched her face for telltale signs of uncertainty in her lyrical description of the dead man's work.
The bigger the gun, the more violent the force it has to tame. There is no room for error. You must bore the tube straight as a ray of light. Its diameter can't vary 1/1 of an inch. Rifling demands the artistry of Michelangelo, shrinking the jacket, the precision of a watchmaker. My father loved his guns. All the great dreadnought men love their work. A steam propulsion wizard like Alistair MacDonald loves his turbines. Ronnie Wheeler up in Newport loves his torpedoes. Farley Kent, his faster and faster hulls. It is joyous to be devoted, Mr. Bell. Such men do not kill themselves.
Joseph Van Dorn intervened again. I can assure you that Isaac Bell's investigation has been as thorough as... But, Bell interrupted, what if Miss Langner is right? His boss looked at him, surprised. Bell said, with Mr. Van Dorn's permission, I will look further. Dorothy Langner's lovely face bloomed with hope. She turned to the founder of the detective agency. Van Dorn spread his hands wide. Of course. Isaac Bell will get right on it with the full support of the agency. Her expression of gratitude sounded more like a challenge. That is all I can ask, Mr. Bell, Mr. Van Dorn, an informed appraisal of all the facts. A sudden smile lit her face like a sunbeam, suggesting what a lively, carefree woman she had been before tragedy struck. Isn't that the least I can expect of a detective agency whose motto is, "We never give up, never"? Apparently, you've investigated us, too. Bell smiled back. Van Dorn walked her out to the reception room, repeating his condolences. Isaac Bell went to the window that faced Pennsylvania Avenue. He watched Dorothy Langner emerge from the hotel with a slender redhead he had noticed earlier in the lobby. In any other company, the redhead would be rated beautiful, but beside the gunner's daughter, she was merely pretty. Van Dorn returned. What changed your mind, Isaac? How she loved her father? No, how she loved his work. He watched them hurry to the stop as a streetcar approached, pick up their long skirts, and climb aboard. Dorothy Langner did not look back. The redhead did, casting an appraising glance up at the Van Dorn windows as if she knew where to look. Van Dorn was studying the photograph. I never saw such a clear picture from film. Ne'er as sharp as a proper glass plate. Marion gave me a 3A Kodak. Fits right in my overcoat. You ought to make them standard equipment. Not at $75 each, said the parsimonious Van Dorn. They can make do with brownies for a buck. What's on your mind, Isaac? You look troubled. I'm afraid you had better assign the accounting boys to look into her father's financial affairs. Why is that? They found a wad of cash in his desk thick enough to choke a cow. A bribe? Van Dorn exploded. A bribe? No wonder the Navy's playing it close to the vest. Langner was a government employee empowered to choose from which foundry to buy steel. He shook his head in disgust. Congress hasn't forgotten the clamor 3 years ago when the Steel Trust fixed the price of armor plates. Well, that explains why she had to relax him. It looks, Isaac Bell admitted, like a clever man did something stupid, couldn't face getting caught, and killed himself. I'm surprised you agreed to look further. She is a passionate young lady. Van Dorn looked at him curiously. You are engaged, Isaac. Isaac Bell faced his boss with a guileless smile. For a man who was worldly in the many ways he would have to be a scourge of criminals, Joe Van Dorn was remarkably prim when it came to affairs of the heart. The fact that I am in love with Marion Morgan does not render me blind to beauty. Nor am I immune to passion. What I meant, however, is that the strikingly attractive Miss Langner's belief in her father is immense. Most mothers, Van Dorn retorted astringently, and all daughters profess disbelief when their sons or fathers engage in criminal acts. Something about that sample of his handwriting struck her oddly. How'd you happen to find the suicide note? The Navy had no clue how to proceed, so they left everything in place except the body and padlocked the door to keep the cops out. How'd you get in? It was an old Pollum. Van Dorn nodded. Bell had a way with locks. Well, I'm not surprised the Navy had no clue how to proceed. In fact, I imagine they're paralyzed with fear. They may have President Roosevelt hell-bent on building 48 new battleships, but there are plenty in Congress scheming to rein them in. Bell said, I hate to leave John Scully in a lurch, but can you keep me off the Fry Boys case while I look into this? A lurch is where Detective Scully likes to be, Van Dorn growled. The man is too independent for my taste. And yet, a clairvoyant investigator, Bell defended his colleague. Scully, an operative not famous for reporting in regularly, was trailing a trio of violent bank robbers across the Ohio-Pennsylvania border. They had made a name for themselves by leaving notes written in the blood of their victims. Fear the Fry Boys. They had robbed their first bank a year ago in New Jersey, fled west, robbing many more, then laid low for the winter. Now they were rampaging east from Illinois in a string of bloody assaults on small-town banks. As innovative as they were vicious, they employed stolen automobiles to cross state lines, leaving local sheriffs in the dust. You will remain in charge of the Fry case, Isaac, Van Dorn said sternly, until Congress gets around to funding some sort of national investigation bureau. The Justice Department will continue to pay us handsomely to capture criminals who cross state lines, and I don't intend to let a maverick like Scully disappoint them. As you wish, sir, Bell replied formally. But you did promise Miss Langner the full support of the agency. All right. I'll shift a couple of men Scully's way, briefly. But you're still in charge, and it should not take you long to confirm the veracity of Langner's suicide note. Can your friend, the Navy Secretary, get me a yard pass? I want to powwow with the Marines. What for? The boss smiled. A rematch. Bell grinned back, but sobered quickly. If Mr. Langner did not kill himself, someone went to a lot of trouble to murder him and besmirch his reputation. The Marines guard the gates of the Navy Yard. They must have seen that someone leave the night before.